You're listening to the Passion City Church DC podcast. To learn more about Passion City Church, including our gathering times in Atlanta and Washington, D.C., visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com. Today's talk comes from Pastor Ben Stewart.
If you've got a Bible, we are in Philippians chapter 1. If you don't have a copy of your scripture with you, don't stress. I'm going to read it to you. We're in a series about home team, about what it's like to be an us. And I want to read to you from Philippians. Philippians is a letter that Paul wrote, the apostle, to his favorite church. I don't know if you can say that, but we're going to say that. It was his favorite church. He's very excited about these guys. And the passage we're going to read is chapter 1, starting verse 12. It's him giving him an update on his own life. And he says this: I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it's become known throughout the whole imperial guard and all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing I'm put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. But what then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. Yes, and I will rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance. As it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not at all be ashamed, but that with full courage, now, as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I'm hard pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and to be with Christ, for that's far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus because of my coming to you again. Let me pray for us. God, I want to thank you for the possibility today to understand our life maybe in a new way, maybe better than we've ever understood it. Not just understand your word, although I'm praying for that, but understand our own lives in a totally different way. I think there's some shifting of perspective you want to do, God. And I just don't want us to miss that. I don't want us to just attend a service. I want us to really meet with you and hear your heartbeat for our lives. And so we're asking you to help us, God. And I want to invite you guys, if you're comfortable and up for it, just take a second quietly to yourself and ask him. Say, God, please teach me today. And then if you would, please pray for me, that the Lord would use me and I'd be helpful to you. Well, Father, we love you and we trust you. Use this time. And we pray that in Jesus' name, amen. Well, I have an older brother, which means growing up, most of my toys were hand-me-downs and arrived to me broken and chewed on and lacking any kind of directions. So where I lacked in instruction, I had to make up for it with creativity. And there are two particular toys I have in mind. One was, you gotta imagine, it was like a yellow funnel. You know, it had a small end and a big open end, but there were holes all through the sides of it, so it was incapable of funneling. But so I would wear it as a hat, right? And then I also had this little red rubber thing that had kind of been accordioned on the side so you could squeeze it. It had a little opening at the top, was rounded at the bottom. So to me, it looked a little bit like a beaker, but you could squeeze it. So for me, it was my mad science lab at bath time. It made bath time tons of fun because I would put different kind of soap and conditioner in it and just be like, I'm making stuff. And then kind of pour it out and be like, science, right? And that was... what I would do in bath time. And that's how I used those things. That's how things went for years. Until after college. I remember there was a day that I was walking into a bank And I was walking into the bank. I saw this little kid there and he had one of those yellow funnel deals. And I was like, that's weird. Like I haven't seen one of those in years. And then I saw him pull out a red rubber squeezy thing. And I was like, how bizarre. He has the same two toys I did as a kid. And then I watched him take them and the narrow end of the funnel thing, he attached to the open end of the red rubber squeezy thing, thereby making one entire unit. And at that time, I stopped what I was doing at the bank and was like, what is going on over there? That's, I never thought to do that. And as I watched him do that, I saw him run over to his dad and his dad handed him a little ball and he dropped the ball into the open end of the funnel and it kind of slid down and stopped at what was now the neck of this one solid piece. And it stopped right there. It wasn't big enough to go through these side slats, but rested there. And then all of a sudden in a moment, I watched the kid hit the red rubber squeezy thing in such a way that it sent air up through the funnel, launching the ball into the air. And then he proceeded to run and attempt to catch the ball in the open end of the funnel. And I remember at that moment, it dawned on me, it's a game. And then I thought, years of my life wasted because I didn't understand how it fit, right? And I watched this little kid experience something I never did. This whole universe of meaning and joy was erupting because he understood the created intent. Right. Now, why am I telling you this? Because we're in the book of Philippians, and the book of Philippians is about, it's got a lot of joy in it. Let me say that. The word joy is mentioned more than any other word, and it's led some people to say, yeah, it's the book about joy. And you go, no, it's not the book about joy. It's a book about the two longings of the human heart, belonging and mattering. And we talked about that as we launched the series, that deep within all of us is the longing to matter, to have a cause worthy of my life. And deep within all of us is a sense of community. I want to belong to something. I want to belong to something and I want to belong to something. I want intimacy and I want impact. And we struggle with how those connect. How do I find love? How do I find purpose? How does all that relate? How does God connect to that? And what we see in Paul is joy erupts from his life, but it's not because he's seeking joy. Some people say, yeah, book, the Philippians is the book about joy. No, it's not about joy. Philippians is a book about a community chasing their God-given cause. And as they link their lives up to their creator's intent for their lives, what you see is shooting out of their life comes great meaning and great joy. That meaning and joy are byproducts of linking my life up with my creator's intent. Paul saw that. Viktor Frankl wrote about that. In that great book, Man's Search for Meaning, he said, don't aim at success. The more you aim at it, the more you're gonna miss it. Success, like happiness, cannot be pursued. It must ensue. It only does so as the side effect of one's dedication to a cause greater than oneself or the byproduct of one's surrender to a person larger than oneself. That we find great meaning and joy when we link our lives up with our Creator's intent. And we all long for that, a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning. It's so important to us. Meaning is vital to our existence. Nietzsche said it, he who has a why to live for can bear almost any how. And it's true. In that same book, Viktor Frankl, who survived the concentration camps in World War II, wrote this, prisoners who gave up on life, who lost all hope for a future, were inevitably the first to die. They died less from lack of food or medicine than from lack of hope, lack of something to live for. It's critical. Tupac taught us that. Why am I dying to live if I'm just living to die? He says, if I don't have a great purpose for me, then I don't know why all this struggle, if it's worth it. I have to have a meaning that gives meaning to the struggle. Do you see it? It's important to us. Now the question comes, where does meaning come from? If we all want our lives to have a sense of purpose, that our daily decisions and our struggles have a meaning bigger than us, where does meaning come from? There are some like Henry Ward Beecher that say the strength and the happiness of a person is finding the way God is going and going that way too. And that's what I've been saying these last few minutes. Your great sense of meaning and joy will come with linking your life up to created intent. But I gotta tell you, not everybody believes that. Stephen Jay Gould, who's a paleontologist, wrote this. Our appearance, talking about humanity on the planet, our appearance looks more like an accidental afterthought than the culmination of a prefigured plan. We're here because an odd group of fishes had a peculiar fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures. Because the earth never froze entirely during an ice age. Because a small, tenuous species arriving in Africa 250,000 years ago has managed so far to survive by hook and by crook. We may yearn for a higher answer, but none exists. This explanation, though superficially troubling, if not terrifying, is ultimately liberating and exhilarating. We cannot read the meaning of life passively in the facts of nature. We must construct these answers for ourselves. There is no other way. Do you hear what he's saying? He's saying there is no creator, so there is no created intent. There is no grand meaning, so you must create your own meaning. What I've been saying to you and what Paul says is there is a creator and he has purpose for you and your joy in life will be linking up to your creator's intent. That's two very different philosophies. Discover the reason why God made you, to know him and make him known, or to make up your own purpose around your career or some interesting thing in your life because there is no ultimate purpose. This is the big divide in our culture. It's a big deal. Now the question is, which one's right? Which one's better? And I could get into a lot of philosophy right now about that. I don't want to do that. I want to take both philosophies and just take them down to the street. And I want to look at them at street level and say, how do they play out? When it plays out in your real life, how do these two philosophies deal with changing circumstances, the success of other people, the weight of your own desires, the well-being of others, and the inevitability of death? Got that? Five things we'll do real quick. It'll be great. If you forgot all that, the first one is changing circumstances. How do these two philosophies deal with shifting circumstances? Let me say this. If you create your own meaning, that meaning can be taken away by any change in circumstance. If you create your own meaning, a series of unfortunate events can not only just rob you of your job, it can rob you of your reason to live. Look at pro athletes. Many of them enjoy playing sports, but it goes beyond playing sports. This is my identity. This is what makes me worthwhile. And if you make that decision, then you are one blowing out of a shoe away from losing your reason to exist. A twisting of a knee could end your whole reason to be alive, right? Or you watch many athletes, they just turn 35. Very dangerous thing to do as an athlete, because what happens? Suddenly you can't perform the same way. And you watch many, you've seen this. People that were very successful in sports, when their season's over, they struggle. And so they begin to turn to drugs and alcohol, or they try to play much longer than they're able to and begin to injure themselves more severely. Why? Because it's not just a job I'm doing or a sport I enjoy, it's my reason. And if you take it away, you've taken away me. Some of us can't really relate to the pro sports life. But maybe for you, it's money. That you go, money is my reason to get a bunch of money so I can get a bunch of things and all the status symbols it brings. And that's the thing. But I was alive and remember what happened in 2008 when the economy downturned. I watched it happen very close by me in the Houston area. People were jumping out of buildings, killed themselves because their bank account was wiped out. And they thought, not only did you wipe out my bank account, you wiped out my reason. And so I'd better die. People chose to die because their money wasn't just their money, it was their source. Do you see that? For some of us, it's our job. If I get this job, then I'm somebody worth knowing and worth seeing and worth living and worth existing. And if I lose that job, I lose me. That's a dangerous thing. Arthur Miller had a play called Incident at Vichy, where he tells a story of a man as the Nazis occupy his city. And this man comes up to them and begins to try to explain to them that he's an important person. And he shows them all his credentials, his university decrees, letters of recommendation from prominent people, all the success and the value he adds to the culture. And he had all this paperwork. And in the play, the Nazi soldier says, "Is that everything?" He said, "Yes." And he grabs all the papers from him and throws it in the trash and says, "Good. Now you're nothing." Let me ask you that question. What's the thing that if we took it away from you, you would feel like you didn't just take a thing, you took away me. You took away my reason. If you're deciding your own purpose in life, you are subject to every wind of change. This is a very tenuous place to be. But if you embrace a God-given reason for your life, then no matter how your circumstances shift, you never lose your sense of meaning, because the God who rules all circumstances rules over your changing circumstances. If God is your reason, then no circumstances can shake you, because he's the Lord of every circumstance. That's Paul's argument in verse 12. The apostle Paul said, I exist for the advance of the gospel, that I'm trying to spread the good news of Jesus everywhere in the world. And Paul was a traveling itinerant, going to all these different cities, starting churches. Look at the map at the back of your Bible, that part you never look at, because it's very confusing, all these kind of colored arrows going places, and you're like, whatever that is. I'll tell you what that is, it's Paul. He's a frequent flyer, he's always moving. That was his life. I'm just moving around telling everybody about Jesus. And then all of a sudden you go, what's the worst thing could happen to Paul? Shackle him down. Stuff him in a prison. That if his sense of meaning was, I'm the itinerant guy, then you take away the itinerant guy. What's going to happen? He's going to write a letter to his friends like, pray for me, y'all. They got me in this prison. I don't even know which way is up anymore. Like, who is Paul really? You know? Is that what he says? No. He says, I want you to know, brothers, what has happened to me actually served to advance the gospel. So that it's become known throughout the whole imperial guard that my imprisonment's for Christ. He says, my identity is not in my traveling. My identity is in God, and God controls all my circumstances. So while I'm free, I'm talking about God all over the place. When they lock me up, I go, all right, I guess I got a prison ministry. What's your name? All right, Bob, you know you need Jesus? Okay, all right. What's your name? Larry, you need Jesus too. Let's go. And he said, I just keep rolling with this. He says, you can't stop me. It just shifts the venue, but I never lose my reason. I'm not threatened by the change of circumstance, because my God controls every circumstance, and he works all things for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. So when God determines my purpose, then wherever I am, I never lose my reason. I remember for me, right when I got out of college, I didn't know what I was gonna do in life. It was like an existential crisis. Like, what am I supposed to do? And I thought, I'm gonna wander the earth in search of adventure and meaning. And that didn't sound that great. And so I took a job as a youth pastor in the suburbs and had a youth ministry of 5 kids that I grew to 1. And I remember in that moment, I was just like, I was struggling. I was like, what am I even doing? Do I wanna be a youth minister? Do I even have a passion for this? I don't even know anymore. And I remember going to a mentor, like, I don't even know what I'm doing in life. I don't wanna live in the suburbs and all this stuff. And I remember he stopped me and he goes, Ben, he said, my job is to know God. And what I do in the world is the overflow of that. Whether I do it through a sermon or do it through the way I make something for his glory, everything I do flows out of that, that I'm made for him. He said, so Ben, I'm made to know him, and right now I do it in this job. And if they like the way I do it, they keep me. If they don't, they'll fire me, but I never lose my job. Do you see that? And that was so clarifying for me. Like, yeah, okay, I don't have to have all this figured out, but I know every day when I wake up, I am made to know him. Now this is eternal life, that I might know you, the only true God and Jesus Christ whom you've sent. Okay, so I woke up every day going, I wanna know him, and he's gonna tell me how to live, I'm gonna live like that. And I watched this ministry grow, and I watched myself grow in it. After a while, I was speaking more and more often, and I realized I gotta get educated, so I left to go to seminary. But fast forward years later, that church that I grew up in gave generously to help launch this church. That we're here because of them. I went to seminary, got educated there, and then got invited to lead a college ministry on the campus of Texas A&M, massive ministry that was on the, you've heard it, okay. It was massive ministry meeting in this basketball arena on campus. I was like, this is incredible, let's do this, we're gonna take over. And I remember showing up there, and I showed up at that arena, and I was like, I just want you to meet me, I'm the new director of this ministry that meets in your auditorium. And the guy was like, that's great, you know, I was looking at the numbers, and y'all really don't pay very much, so I'm gonna triple your rent here on a weekly basis. And he told me the number, and I was like, you just killed us. I was like, we just got here, but we don't have any, I can't afford that. It's like, I just took over this ministry, and you killed it. I was like, now you're gonna get no money, and we can't meet here. This is horrible. And I remember I went back and started praying, because I was like, God, I don't, what just happened? I became captain of the Titanic. Like, let's go, everyone. I was like, it's a huge mistake. And I was just like, what are we gonna do? And I was like, what's gonna happen? And was freaking out and praying, and some people heard about it, and those people began to introduce me to people, and those people began to introduce me to people, and suddenly all this world and orbit of people came around us that said, hey, what you're doing is worthy to exist. And so they began to pour money into it and said, we're gonna fund it to meet that number. And so they began to fund it so we could pay that rent. Meanwhile, I went back to the guy who ran the arena Argentina, and a couple months later, God had convicted his heart. He didn't even understand why. He said, I can't sleep at night. You know what? I can't do this. It may cost me my job, but I'm lowering your rent. And so he lowered the rent while our revenues went up, so we were able to do more ministry than ever. And not only more ministry than ever, these guys that supported that also gave generously so we could launch this church, which worked out pretty good and is pretty incredible. And then as I was leaving Breakaway, I was invited by Passion to write a book. And I was like, that's so crazy. There's a book I've always wanted to write. And so I spent 3 months trying to write just the outline and was unsuccessful. You're like, how do you try to write an outline for 3 months? It's not great. And I tried it and couldn't do it. And so one moment in frustration, I was like, let me just give myself a mental break. And I sketched out the outline of a book on singleness, dating, engaged, married in about less than 5 minutes. And I was like, I think I'm supposed to write a book about dating. It's like, no, God. I don't want to be the dating guy. It's not good. But I was like, but this is all I have. And I thought in my mind, I was like, all right, then this is my swan song to cautions, because God was starting to call me to do this. And I was like, all right, this is going to be like, here's the best I got, young people, about how to pursue love. And just let me shove this into your world as I pray blessings over your life. This is all I got. And then I'm going to leave and do this whole new chapter of my life. And so I showed up here with that and walked in. I remember the first time I met somebody at the Capitol, it was a guy that worked there. And I just said, man, how can we serve your people? What are the needs of your people? And I just asked that blanket question. I remember he stopped and he went, nobody knows how to date. He said, you think you're gonna talk about that? And I said, I think I got a little something. And like a month later, I was speaking in the Senate offices to a crowd of people about, in a suit, about dating. I was like, if you would ask me my plan, like, man, how are you gonna get in the Capitol? Well, I'm gonna write a book about dating for young people. Who does that? God does that. He just does that. I'm gonna maneuver your life into places that make no sense. But when you give it enough time and pull the lens back, you go, oh, I think somebody's driving and this all makes sense. And so I trust him. So when my circumstances go sideways and the money doesn't come in, I go, okay, well, I trust you with that. Whatever you wanna do with that, I don't know what story you're writing. When my story goes this way and you go, minister to these 5 people, I'm gonna do that. I'm not worried that the 5's not 50. I'm gonna do that. When I'm at this job, you go, I don't know if this is my forever job, but I know I'm your person, I'm your man, your woman in this job. I'm gonna do that. And I trust and I have peace and a sense of purpose because I know that God who leads me controls every circumstance I'm in. That's a better place to live. It really is. And Paul sees that joy. The city of Dothan is mentioned twice in the Bible. Tim Keller said this. I thought it was so profound. He said, the city of Dothan shows up 2 places in the Bible. First time, little Joseph's there and his brothers throw him into a well and sell him into slavery. And Joseph's crying out for help and God doesn't answer. And Joseph's carried off to Egypt. Dothan's mentioned 1 other time. Elisha is there and an enemy comes to attack him. And Elisha prays and an army of heavenly warriors lit up with the flames of fire surround Elisha. 2 moments in Dothan, 2 prayers. 1, God shows up mightily with the chariots. 1 is met with silence. But for Joseph, as he's carried off to Egypt, he slowly becomes second in command in Egypt. God gives him the ability to interpret dreams, to see a famine coming, makes him second in command. Suddenly he's ruling all of Egypt and takes the resources of Egypt and turns it to keep not only Egypt alive, but also his brothers whom he's forgiving because he trusts God's control of his life. And you see that even when God shows up mightily to answer your prayers or even when God lingers, God works all things for the good of those who love him and called according to his purpose. So I don't know if you feel like God's answering your prayers or not, but he's in control of your circumstances, I promise you. And when you trust him, there is great joy and no knowing a God like that. That's point 1. The rest will go faster. Number 2 is success of other people. If you're just creating your own meaning in life, then every other person who's decided to find their meaning doing the same thing is a threat. See that? It's a threat. If I say, I'm gonna find all my meaning in being the funny guy, like that's your thing. Like I'm the guy that makes everybody laugh. I'm kind of the joker. Like my social media is always filled with funny stuff. The way I equip with people is great. What happens? Some of you have been here. What happens when someone else enters your circle of friends and he's kind of funny too? And he says something funny and everyone starts laughing. You're like, ah, ha, ha, ha. I hate that guy. He should be stopped, right? Or others of you, maybe you're like, you know what? I'm the best dresser in the room. You know, there's other people that work smarter than me. There's other people at work that are maybe extending their careers. faster, but I always look fantastic, and they don't. And then suddenly someone shows up at the office that looks amazing. You're like, oh, wow, that's a great outfit. Did you steal that from someone? You wicked, wicked. Right? Like, you just can't celebrate them, right? We're like Salieri, remember in the Mozart movie? I make beautiful music. Now he makes beautiful music. If this music is not just music, but it's my reason for existence, then I can't celebrate his music. I hate him because he's a threat to me. Louis C.K. admitted that to Jimmy Fallon. Louis C.K. was on the board deciding who was going to get on this new sketch comedy show, and young Jimmy Fallon showed up to audition. And he told him later on The Tonight Show, he said, I remember your audition. You showed up and you were so young and fit and funny and cool, and you made me feel so insecure, I torpedoed your career. He said, you totally deserve that role. You were such a threat to me, I couldn't have you around me. And Fallon turned out fine. That's Louis C.K.'s deal, isn't it? If I find my meaning in a thing, and you're better than me at that thing, you're stealing from me my meaning. The success of others is a threat to you. But if you embrace a God-given purpose, then people who are pursuing that same thing, they're either an ally in the fight or someone hurting worth fighting for. That's who they are. That's Paul's situation. Paul says, most of the brothers being confident because of my imprisonment are much bolder to speak the word without fear. And then he says, some of them preaching out of envy and rivalry, some out of goodwill, some out of selfish ambition, some because they love me. He says, there's different kind of people. What happened was when Paul got locked up, there was a leadership vacuum. Paul was out there leading the churches. Now he's locked up and people saw that vacuum. And there were some guys that were like, someone's got to step in and lead us. Someone has to keep the charge going. Someone got to keep the gospel going out. And there were young guys that loved Paul. They were like, for the love of Paul and the message, let's step up and do it, guys. Let's get out there. Let's do it. It's our turn. It's our time. Let's go. And there are other people that were like, oh, Paul is taken out. Now is my chance to step into the spotlight. It's my turn to shine. Paul was never right for us, people. Welcome to me. And he said, there's different kinds of people with different kind of motives. And then when Paul records how he feels about that in verse 18, he says, what then? Translation is, I don't care. He says, are they preaching Christ? Then I rejoice. He said, if my goal was, I want God to use Paul, then when God uses other people, I'm threatened. But if my goal is, I want people to know God, if you're good at it too, you're an ally. If you don't know him yet, you're someone worth fighting for. Do you see that? So I'm never fighting with that other person. I'm either fighting with you or I'm fighting for you. I'm never fighting against you. If I have a God-given purpose, you're not a threat. You're an ally or someone worth fighting for. Do you see that? There's a peace in Paul because there's no competition with him. I win. Man, we ran into that in this city. You know, when you launch into a new church, you want to believe that all churches are like, welcome to the party. Let's all seek Jesus together. But you know, churches are made up of humans and humans aren't perfect. And so you worry. Man, some churches might see us as competition, see us as a threat. It might get insecure and backbitey and weird. When we showed up in this town, we were praying. It wouldn't feel like that. And I remember when we walked in, I made a goal. I wanted to meet as many pastors as I could just to let them know, hey, we're here to be a friend. We win when we all grow. There's a lot of people to reach. I had that whole speech planned. So I mapped out all these people, called up all these guys. And people were telling me, man, you got to go meet Mark Dever over at Capitol Hill Baptist. I was like, all right, I'm going to do it. And remember, as I got prepared to do that, there were people telling me like, hey man, you just need to know, he's kind of like the theology guy. He's like the ecclesiology guy, like about the church. So he's probably gonna quiz you in front of all his people and you just better get ready because he's gonna throw some questions at you and you better have good answers. And I'm like, okay. So I literally pulled out all my old seminary books. I'm like, okay, ecclesia what? And super lahun, let me get this ready. And I remember walking to his office. I'm like, I don't wanna do this. It's so stressful. Like, why am I even doing this? But I showed up there really unsure what was gonna happen. And I remember as I walked up to him, he's like, let's go take a walk. We walked outside. And as soon as we got outside, he stopped, put his hand on my shoulder and said, church, ekklesia in Greek. Ek means out, kaleo means to call. The called out ones, the assembly. And I'm like, here we go. He's spouting Greek. This is the ekklesia, it's the called out ones. One assembly, one group. So here at this church, we have this conviction that we're only gonna have one service time, one group. And our service is jammed. So we need more people to reach the city. So I'm so glad you're here. Welcome to the city. anything I can do to help you, I want to help you. Come meet everybody. And he walked me into his office, walked me around, introduced me to everyone in the office. And he would walk up to people and be like, hey, you should try to steal this guy. He's going to like your music better than ours. Hey, you meet this guy. And I'm just like, what? What? Really? I was like, who says this? But I just saw this completely generous spirit, because in him, it wasn't like, no, God can only use Mark. He says, no, God gets to use Mark. And I want him to use a lot of people, because I want a lot of people to know Jesus. That's a safer place to live. I had an appointment on the books with Mark Batterson before I could ever meet him, the pastor of NCC. We got a check in the mail supporting us as we launched. What kind of attitude is that? Yeah, so yeah, you can clap for that, because that's pretty incredible. T.L. Rogers was the pastor of Triumphant Church, pastor for 40 years in this city. T.L. Rogers, I invited him to come to Passion Conference, and he showed up and saw that room full of young people worshiping, and I'll never forget walking up to him. He just grabbed me and hugged me and just like, look at all these people, look at them, they're worshiping. And I'm like, I know, right? And it was just so crazy. And after that, he reached out to me and said, hey, I want you to drive around with me and my son, Perrin, who is now the pastor of Triumphant Church. And he said, I want to drive you around because we want to show you the parts of DC you know and probably the parts you don't know. And they drove me around, and they host a breakfast that brings pastors together so we can be brothers. And I look in the city and go, that's such a better place to live. God loves that, that we figure out how to get along. Man, if I have a God-given purpose, you're not a threat to me. You're either a brother to fight alongside or a person worth fighting for. But I have security because I'm his. You see it? Number three is the weight of your own life and desires. The weight of your own desire. If you choose your own meaning, then you are putting so much freight, your reason for existence, on a thing, whatever that thing may be. That's dangerous. We saw it in Chariots of Fire. Do you remember the movie, Harold Abrams, competing in the Olympics in the 1920s? He said, I have 10 lonely seconds to justify my existence. That's how we saw this race. I get all my sense of purpose in a race. I have 10 lonely seconds to justify my existence. And then he says, and even if I win, I don't know if I have. What if I get it? I don't know if it'll satisfy me. But right next to him was Eric Liddell, the believer in Jesus. And what did he say? He told his sister, oh, Jenny, God made me fast. And when I run, I feel God's pleasure, right? I can't really do Irish, whatever, it's fine. But what's the point? He said, God made me and I exist for him. And as I pursued him, he showed me what I'm built for. Some are built to preach, some are built to be architects. He said, I'm built fast. And when I run, it's for his glory. So he enjoyed running, right? Do you see the difference? He wasn't putting the freight of his existence on a thing. He was therefore free to enjoy the thing. But if you put all your meaning on a thing, it can't handle the weight of your desire. Boris Becker shocked the world. After he won Wimbledon for a second time, he was asked in an interview, you're on top of the world, what's that like? And he started talking about his thoughts of suicide. Like, what? Suicide, you're at the top of your game. But for him, it's a terrifying thing to get everything you wanted and find yourself still empty. That's a terrifying thing. Jack Higgins wrote 60 novels, all of them bestsellers. How many writers would love just a fraction of that success? And so he was asked a softball question by an interviewer. What would you tell your young self about getting in the biz? And he said, I would tell me that when you get to the top, there's nothing there. That's what he said. That's what Jay-Z's been trying to say. I remember when Holy Grail came out. Remember they did these series of videos of him there making this album with Timbaland's in the room and Pharrell's in the room, and then this crazy looking hippie guy with long hair and a beard, barefoot, laying on the couch. And you're like, who is that guy? And it was Rick Rubin, the star producer, the guy that's produced everybody in the whole world. You're like, what is the deal with Rick Rubin? And these whole videos then become a dialogue with Rick Rubin and Jay-Z. And Jay was talking about, man, when I was poor, all I cared about was getting success so I could get wealth so it could create options. He said, that was it. And then when I got it and I still had pain, it just threw him for a loop. He said, so I thought if I got all these things, it would make me happy. And then Rick Rubin finished the sentence, but it really didn't, did it? Because things can't satisfy the human heart. They can't. And so he's singing it in the songs about the Holy Grail. At the end of the song, he just says, you're still alive. That's the best he can say about his existence with it. So he wrote the song, I Just Want a Picasso. And he says in that interview, it just became ridiculous. Oh, well, if I could just get a Picasso, then I'll feel better. And you're like, how ridiculous is that? And he realized these things that I thought were so important can't satisfy the deepest part of me. That's a destabilizing thing. It can't handle the weight of your desire. New York Times just had an article come out this week by Charles something. I'm not going to pronounce his last name. Pulitzer Prize winning journalist wrote The Power of Habit. The title of the article was Wealthy, Successful, and Miserable. The upper echelon is hoarding money and privilege to a degree not seen in decades, but that does not make them happy at work. And he talks about how he got an MBA at Harvard. And he said, when I was young going through Harvard, it was like having the golden ticket, man. He said, I knew if you're at Harvard, you're gonna get a great job. You're gonna get money, power, influence. He said, it's gonna be amazing. And he said, he got that MBA. And then he talks about going back to his 15-year high reunion. And he said, it was shocking to see the volume of my former classmates who weren't overjoyed in their professional lives. In fact, they were miserable. He says, and they talked about missed promotions, disaffected children, billable hours in divorce court. They complained about jobs that were unfulfilling, tedious. One classmate described having to invest $5 million a day, which didn't sound terrible, until he explained that if he only put $4 million to work, he had to scramble to put $6 million to work on Tuesday, and his coworkers were constantly undermining one another in search of the next promotion. It was insanely stressful work done among people he didn't like. He was earning about $1.2 million a year, but hated going to the office. Now, I know some of you hear that, and you're like, earning $1.2 million a year? Aw, I feel so bad for you. Like, hang in there, man. Be strong. Get over it, right? Find some meaning, get a hobby. But you gotta understand how stressful that is. To think a thing would fill that ache and to get that thing and to see that it doesn't. He said, this guy said to him, I feel like I'm wasting my life. When I die, is anyone gonna care I earned an extra percentage point? My work feels totally meaningless. And then in the rest of the article, he cites that over half of Americans say the same thing. What I get up and do with most of my waking hours feels meaningless. That's a terrifying place to live. If I put all of my meaning on the meaning in my work and I get it and it doesn't satisfy, that's a dangerous place. Paul, however, has a different experience and he uses two words that are so great, progress and joy. He says, when I look at my life, I'm pursuing an inexhaustible God. I can always progress in faith. And I'm pursuing helping people know him. I can always progress and help them progress in their joy. It's amazing for him. That's where he gets into this part where he says, whether they're in pretense or truth, if they're preaching Christ, I rejoice. And I know that through your prayers, I'm gonna get out of jail. He says, and it's my eager expectation and hope. I won't be ashamed, but with full courage, as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or death. He says, no matter what happens, Jesus Christ is going to be honored in me. I have a God-given purpose, and he's going to get honored with me, whether by life or by death. And then he says that beautiful line, for to me to live is Christ and to die is gain. And then he says in the next line, if I'm a live in the flesh, it's fruitful labor for me, yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. And it's the funniest thing, if I can geek out about the original language he wrote it in, the Greek at that point suddenly gets messy. Like literally the grammar breaks down. And commentators are like, it looks like Paul was in a flow and then he broke his own train of thought. He says, forever, as always, Christ will be honored in my body, for to live is to Christ and to die is gain, and which I shall choose. I don't know. I mean, dying would be better because I get out of jail, it's nice, and I get to be with him. And I want to be with him. So to be with Jesus, if he's my goal, to be in his presence is gain. But to stay with you is fruitful labor. I don't know what I want to choose. And then he says, I can tell you guys need me. Well, I'm going to exist. All right, done, right? And then he says, if I go on living in the flesh, that means it's to help you progress in your joy and your faith. Do you see that? To live is Christ. What does that mean? It means I pursue Christ. What does that mean? It means I help people he made progress in faith. I want you to know him more. And then I help you enjoy him more. Isn't that great? The article ends and it quotes all these different stats and different studies in New York Times. He said, you know the happiest people? He said, they did studies on janitors at this one hospital. Why are they happier than even the doctors at that hospital? It's because in this little community of janitors, they understood, we're not just here sweeping floors. They said, this community had said, hey, what we're doing is making the difference in the lives of people. People who have dignity and value. And they started every day thinking about how can we make little changes in the way we do our work that help other people, help them experience life more, trust God more, grow more as people. And that sense of meaning shot through the most mundane with the eternal. And Paul looks at his life and says, I have continual progress. I'm not gonna arrive at the top and feel there's nothing there. I am continually pressing towards eternity. And all along the way, there's more and more people made in God's image. And I get to help you know him more. And there's more and more of you that don't know the joy of knowing him, so I'm gonna help you every day. And to wake up every day knowing wherever I'm an architect or whether I'm a janitor, I exist to help people not just know God, but enjoy God, to increase their value in life. That's a continued progress in joy. That can handle the freight of me. That I may change careers, I may change the way I do things, I may change the amount of money I have, but I have a continual, beautiful variety in front of me. Because there's always more progress in knowing him, and there's always more progress in making him known, and I live to bring you joy. Number four is it anchors our morality, the well-being of other people. That if I'm creating my own meaning, then whatever meaning I create, I know is ultimately meaningless. And so the meaning I make is meaningless. That's a scary place to be. That's what Bertrand Russell struggled with. Bertrand Russell wrote this, he was like, that man, speaking of us, is the product of causes which had no provision of the end they were achieving. He says, you're an accident. That your origin, growth, hopes, fears, loves, beliefs are the outcome of an accidental collocation of atoms. He said, everything you believe and love is an accident. That no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought or feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. That all the labors of the ages, the noonday brightness of human genius is destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system. That the whole temple of man's achievement must be buried in the inevitable debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are so nearly certain, no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation be safely built. Isn't that life-giving? Don't you want that on a coffee mug every morning? Everything you love, everything you care about, everything you do is an accidental collocation of atoms that will burn up in the fiery death of the universe. Thanks, Bertrand. He says, yeah, when you put that in your vision, all you're left with is an unyielding despair. It doesn't mean anything. So create your little meaning, but just know when you die, it all goes away. When you have that life, it's hard to justify, well, I just live to love people. Well, that person you love is an accidental collocation of atoms that's gonna burn up in the universe. So your love's meaningless and so is that person. Stop saying that, Bertrand, right? It's very hard to deal with. To say that every little meaning I try to create will ultimately get destroyed. And so love is meaningless. Caring for people is meaningless. Social justice is meaningless. Why help you? Because ultimately you go away and everything goes away and nothing matters. Does that mean people who don't believe in God can't be moral? No, but it means their morality outstrips their philosophy. Because the philosophy ends you with nothing matters, even love, even people. But for the Christian, we look and Paul says, my existence is for your joy. When my life is Christ, to live as Christ, when I look at him, he puts my eyes on you. And he says, they're made in my image. Love them. Love them if they love you back. Love them if they hate you back. Love them if they understand you. Love them if they misunderstand you. Love them if they're gracious. Love them if they're screaming. Love them because I made them and I value them. You love them. You cherish these people because they have an eternal destiny in me and I want them to know me. And so it anchors my morality. So yes, I fight against poverty. Yes, I fight against injustice. Yes, I fight to help people rise. Yes, I fight for the sake of those who can't fight for themselves. Why? Because they have meaning and value that's eternal and ultimate that will not fade, will not be destroyed, will go on to forever. And so my morality is anchored in eternity. So I love you because you were made by him. And the fact that I serve him means I love you no matter the cost. Do you see it? My morality is anchored in eternity. And the last thing is the inevitability of death. If you create your own meaning, death takes it all. If Jesus Christ is your purpose, then every person you lead to him goes racing into eternity with you. Everything done in his name is a cause for celebration and forever. Every step taken for his glory is gloriously celebrated by him and you and all who benefited by it. Everything I do, even the most mundane, is shot through with eternal meaning if I'm his. To live is Christ, and to die is gain because I get to see him. You see it? Shot through with meaning. So which philosophy is better? Which one solves that deep ache in the heart? You have an eternal ache for meaning, because you were meant to anchor your meaning in an eternal God. That's where you'll find peace. That's where you'll find satisfaction. That's where you'll find joy. The highest satisfactions experienced, the greatest potential will be reached when you snap your life into your created intent to know him and make him known. What Paul does here, what he's offering for us to do, is put the world in checkmate. I don't know if you play chess. I don't really. But if you know chess, it's interesting. A couple years ago, there was a huge moment in New York City. 23-year-old Magnus Carlsen, the chess world champion, faced off against Garry Kasparov, the former world champion. It's a pretty big deal. One commentator who was interviewed at the time said, it's not often you get the Michael Jordan and LeBron James of chess in the same room. Which I think is interesting because he's trying to explain how massive this moment was, but to do it, he has to explain some other sport. Like, doesn't that kind of put your sport in check? You know what I mean? Like, I don't think LeBron's going over there like, this is like the Garry Kasparov of basketball. Like, nope, people aren't doing it over there, so get a little humility. But they showed up at this and they asked one person at the event, how do you describe watching these two masters together? And this young man said, life fulfilling. Kasparov, the former champion, showed up 30 minutes late because, and I quote, the world waits for Kasparov. Does it though? He ended up losing, which he protested because he said it was an exhibition, neither here nor there. But if you've never played chess, what were they going for? What's the goal? Well, to state it simply, you're moving your pieces in a way where no matter what happens next, you can't win and I can't lose. That's what you're trying to do. I'm trying to position the pieces in a way that no matter what happens next on the board, there's no way I lose and there's no way you can win. That's when I put you in checkmate. You can't make a move that causes me to lose. I got you in checkmate. Look at Paul. Paul, the itinerant minister. We're gonna lock you up in a prison. All right, I'll have a prison ministry. At the end of the letter, he was like, hey, say hi to everybody. Oh, and a special shout out's coming from all the believers from Caesar's household. You can't stop him. He just got a prison ministry. And they're like, all right, fine. We'll have you lose Instagram followers because other preachers will get more famous than you. He's like, are they preaching Jesus? Yeah. I win. Then we're going to kill you. To die is gain. Then we're going to not kill you. Fruitful ministry. Dang it. Every move they make. He says, you can't win. I can't lose. When my meaning is anchored in the one who made the stars, I got the world in checkmate. You can't stop me. Shift my circumstances, you don't shake me. My anchor is in a firm foundation. Yours might shake, mine are firm, because I'm his. And I walk with him for the progress of the gospel, for the progress of your faith, for the progress of your joy. Every day I get to know him more and leverage me for the sake of his glory in your life, whether it be through architecture or preaching or dance. I just take all of me and aim it at all of him for the benefit of all of you. And when I snap my life into created intent, a whole universe of meaning and joy explodes into my world. And no matter what you throw at me, I got you in checkmate because I'm his.
If you were encouraged by today's talk, be sure to rate us and hit subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever you stream your podcasts. To experience other talks, videos, and live gatherings, visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com or download the Passion Movement app. And again, thanks for listening to the Passion City Church DC podcast.